whose bedroom in the middle of the night.
I wouldn't, she answered quickly. But if we tell Cinda at dinner that Baneth proposed to me, then I can legitimately discover the body sooner rather than later.
A sound idea, but it had been thought of too quickly. Did the king propose to you?
Her face was scarlet. Though he wouldn't have understood what Alex asked, the king answered in Khimasar.
I asked Seish to marry me 2 nights ago.
Alex looked back and forth between the two of them.
And what was the answer?
It was no, said Baneth.
After they'd developed a plan for that evening, Alex had to rest again, though he refused the healer's strong recommendation that he take their formula to sleep better. Wonderful as that fog had felt, a clear mind was more important. He also suspected Sage hadn't slept in weeks, and Alex convinced her she wouldn't hurt him by curling up beside him. In truth, it was painful when she bumped or brushed against him, but having her close was worth it. It was late afternoon when he woke alone. Everything hurt again, and his joints didn't want to bend. Alex was used to injuries, though the last time he'd been nearly this bruised all over was during his early page days, when a squire had openly questioned Lady Quinn's faithfulness to Alex's father. Officially, he'd been disciplined and had a talking down from Colonel Quinn himself, but unofficially, he and the boys who'd joined in to help him were given extra rations for a week. He was stretching and working things loose when Sage came in from the garden, dressed in what looked like riding clothes, with a Kazmuni sword belted at her waist. She was sweaty and disheveled, but cheerful, explaining she'd been learning some kind of fighting with Princess Lani, who'd needed to work off a lot of anger.
How do you feel? She asked, sitting on the bed and leaning down for a kiss. A lot of the swelling in your face is down.
Better now that I've seen you again, but very sore, he admitted.
Sage looked over some of his bandages, touching him more than she probably needed to, but he didn't complain.
Do you want to stay here tonight?
Baneth was worried you wouldn't be up to it.
I think another bath will do me good.
He'd been unconscious for most of it, but last night they'd kept him in a medicinal bath for several hours. She stood and began unbuckling her sword belt.
I'll call for it, but me first. Even I can smell how bad I stink.
Alex pushed himself upright as she headed toward the bathing room.
You know, that tub is large enough for both of us, he called.
Don't tempt me.
An hour later, he was soaking as Sage prepared for dinner with the king and Minister Cinda. After he assured her he was covered, she walked in the room, wearing a forest green dress with draped sleeves. The style hugged her slender figure and left much less to the imagination than the full, billowy outfits Damoran women wore.
Please tell me you're bringing that dress with you when we return to Damora, he said.
She smiled and sat on a stool next to him. The scent of orange blossoms and jasmine washed over him. Not the lavender and sage he was used to, but it didn't bother him as much as he might have thought.
What shall I tell Baneth? She asked. Are you well enough to help? No one will think less of you if you aren't recovered.
Did she really expect him to hide in her room while assassins were in the palace?
I'm fine, he assured her.
She nodded and twisted her hands in her lap, biting her lip.
Trust me, Sage.
It's not that, she said. It's...
Sage took a deep breath. Baneth wasn't quite honest when he said I'd turned down his proposal.
I see.
But I hadn't said yes either, she rushed to say. I promised him an answer in a few days.
Sage,
he only wanted to assure our safety and force the council to talk to the Damorans when they arrived, rather than fight.
Love.
He doesn't love me. It was purely political, for peace. He told me we didn't have to have children.
Sage,
I only considered it because I didn't want to go back to Damora if you weren't there.
Alex had already made peace with the idea, given that she'd thought he was dead.
He sat up and brought his face close to hers.
I wouldn't have blamed you for saying yes, Sage.
She blinked, tears collecting in her lashes. Is that truth?
Truth,
he whispered, before kissing her long and hard. She looked like she needed it.
Alex sat back, trying not to wince, and added, If you'd still said yes after you'd found me, then I'd be worried.
Sage wiped her eyes and laughed. Sweet spirit, he'd missed that sound. He'd never do anything to make it go away again. All right, I have to leave. The healers will bandage you this time.
She stood, and he was free to admire her again. You're only wearing one knife,
Alex said, hissing in pain as his torn and bloody wrists slipped back into the water. Lonnie says two look ridiculous when wearing a dress. She fingered the letters on the hilt. It's yours. No matter how much I hang on Baneth tonight, I've got your initials at my waist.
Alex frowned a little. But you normally carry two.
Yes, so? She cocked her head to the side.
Realization dawned on her, and Alex nodded. Maybe we should consider changing our plan slightly.
Chapter 97 Sage was impressed by Lonnie's composure throughout dinner. When Minister Cinda took her hand to kiss it in greeting, the princess traced her fingers over the distinctive stones he wore in his rings with a flicker of anger in her eyes. All traces of doubt swept away. After that, she smiled and giggled through the first two courses, casting her eyes on him every few minutes and playing the giddy bride-to-be. The wine may have helped. As for Sage, her anxiety wasn't difficult to disguise as nervousness over Baneth's coming announcement. Twice he reached for her hand, and she flushed and tried to look back, doe-eyed. Cinda frowned slightly each time. Baneth had suggested leaving Nicholas out of the evening, saying it only increased the chances something would be given away. But Sage was unwilling to let the prince out of her sight. If Alex was right, there might be an opportunity while they were at dinner to catch one or both of the assassins. She didn't want to risk something happening to Nicholas while Alex and Derrett were busy. Baneth needn't have worried, though. Nicholas played his role well. When Cinda asked Baneth if he could marry Lonnie, she blushed and then cried when the king granted his permission. The princess's limit, however, was reached when Cinda went to kiss her. Lonnie turned her cheek to him. Don't think you can take liberties now, she said teasingly, as she met Sage's eyes with a different look entirely. Cinda kissed Lonnie chastely and returned to his seat. Baneth cleared his throat and took Sage's hand again.
I had not thought to say anything yet, but now seems opportune.
He raised Sage's fingers to his lips and looked at her in a way that made her wonder if he'd been truthful when he said he didn't love her.
This afternoon, I asked Mistress Sage to marry me.
Nicholas cheered and jumped up to kiss Sage on the cheek, then went to shake the king's hand, while Baneth looked genuinely puzzled at the gesture. In the corner of Sage's vision, Cinda tensed, then recovered and smiled. Lonnie beamed at him. Isn't it wonderful, Dev?
Most wonderful, he replied, raising his glass. I wish Palandrit all the happiness I expect to have.
He took a sip, without waiting for anyone else to join his toast.
When does my king intend to tell the council?
Tomorrow, said Baneth.
With the De Morins coming, I wish to proceed as soon as possible.
He glanced at Sage meaningfully.
The sooner this union is cemented, the better for both nations.
Sage flushed and looked away. Cinda's smile widened. For the rest of the meal, they discussed when the weddings should be held and who should be involved. Minister Cinda insisted no money for his and Lonnie's should come from the treasury, that he would bear the cost himself. The hard gleam in Lonnie's eyes told Sage she was tallying every minute of his betrayal for repayment.
Chapter 98.
Alex nestled behind an ornate tapestry in the dark corner of Sage's dressing room, thinking how funny it was to have such a decorated closet, when he heard the door to the servants' passage open in the next room. He flexed his hands a few times before going perfectly still and waited for the shadows to go through her room, searching. Not finding what they wanted, the Dolophon came into the dressing room and began touching and pressing fabrics and items lying around.
"Here," one whispered in Kimisar.
He slid Sage's second dagger from under a pile of silk. Alex recognized Cameron's profile as he made a face.
"You win. I'll go secure our escape route."
Stesh tucked the knife in his belt.
"I'll wait in the garden where I can see when he puts the lamp out." "Don't get caught, little brother."
Cameron flicked his ear.
"I won't save your pretty little nose this time."
The Kimisar made an obscene gesture and slipped out the door. Cameron stayed behind, poking through Sage's things and tucking a few pieces of jewelry in his vest. Alex had been worried about losing the man while following him, but Cameron's greedy delay meant Alex was able to take him down right there. After using several of the silk scarves lying around to bind the Kimisar, Alex poured a triple dose of medicinal tea on the man's gag. Then he dragged the limp body out of the room and back into the servants' corridor. About halfway there, Alex realized he'd overestimated how much his body could take. Though brief, his struggle with Cameron had exhausted him and undoubtedly set some of his healing back a few days. He had to rest every few feet, and it took much longer than expected to reach Banneth's room. Originally, Alex had planned to be there, waiting with Derek, but when he'd seen Sage dressed for dinner and wearing only one knife at her waist, it occurred to him how she could be blamed, and he decided to wait in her room. Derek's relief was plain on his face when Alex finally appeared.
"I had to admit, there was a part of me that did not trust your honesty,"
the Kazmuni told Alex as he took the Kimisar's legs and helped carry him into the bathing room. Alex wasn't insulted.
"I have much to atone for with you, Derek," he said, "especially as you saved Sage and my prince."
Derek only nodded. Once the Kimisar was set against a wall and his restraints rechecked, Alex collapsed in a corner. The next thing he knew, the king had returned from dinner.
"Sage is in her room," Banneth said, gently shaking Alex's shoulder. "She will wait for you to return before coming here."
Alex rubbed the sleep from his eyes.
"Where is Derek?"
"He left after the guards saw me speak with him. That way he has an excuse to be close when my body is found."
The king pulled a familiar black-handled dagger from his jacket.
"Sage sends you this."
"Thanks."
Alex used the wall to help him stand and accepted the weapon. On the opposite side of the room, Cameron was still unconscious, his half-open eyes glazed with the effects of the sedatives. Banneth watched Alex walk around to loosen his muscles.
"I know you are risking your life now for Sage and Nicolas," he said, after a few silent minutes. "But this is also for me, and I am grateful."
"I, too, have much to be grateful for," said Alex simply.
The king hesitated.
"I would have treated her well, but I knew that she would never care for me like she cares for you."
"I know this."
Alex paused to offer Banneth a smile.
"That is why I am not angry. Besides,"
he looked away, because there was a small part of the situation that was painful, even if he didn't want to admit it.
"I cannot blame you for seeing her worth."
Derek returned then, and Banneth went about preparing for bed as though nothing was wrong. A manservant helped him undress, while Alex and Derek stayed out of sight. Once his man was dismissed for the evening, Banneth settled cushions under the bedclothes to make it look like he was there, extinguished the lantern, and slipped back into the bathing room. He'd wanted to stay in the bed as bait, but both Alex and Derek considered that too dangerous.
They took places in the corners of Baneth's silent bedchamber and waited.
Alex almost missed the man's entry. The assassin came in with a breeze that rippled the sheer curtains leading to the patio. Dark as it was outside, the king's chambers were darker, giving Alex and Darrett a slight advantage. The moon wasn't up, and Stesh cast no shadow as he glided, wraith-like, into the room. Despite the Khemisar's intentions, Alex couldn't help admiring the man's stealth. Stesh had his back to Darrett's corner, and as he approached the king's bed, the Kazmuni eased away from the wall. Alex was in his line of sight and didn't dare move. There was a low hiss as the assassin slid Sage's knife free of the sheath. One hand reached for the lump on the bed. The hand froze, and the man stepped back. Darrett was still halfway across the room. Before Stesh could turn around, Alex leapt from his corner, resisting the urge to throw his knife. They wanted him alive. The assassin reacted instantly, hurling the dagger in his hand at Alex, but Alex was already diving down to the carpet. His intention had been only to give Darrett a chance to get closer. A burning stripe across his left shoulder told him he'd been grazed by the blade. The impact on the floor was far worse, and Alex nearly blacked out from the pain as he rolled into the side of the bed, clutching his bleeding arm. By the time Alex had recovered enough to stand, Darrett was struggling with Stesh on the other side of the bed. For a moment, he hesitated, unsure which man was which in the darkness. Then the pair separated. Darrett's sword swung out, and Stesh deflected it with a curved dagger. Alex flung his knife at the Khemisar's hand, knocking it away, and Darrett sliced around. Stesh dropped to his knees, clutching his middle. Darrett kicked him over and stepped on his neck to hold him down as Alex slumped on the bed, gasping.
Palandrit, Darrett called softly.
It is finished.
Chapter 99. Sage sat in her room, trying not to vomit from the coppery smell of blood all over her nightdress. It reminded her of waking up, drenched in the blood of the first man she'd killed. The man who formerly owned this blood wasn't dead, though. At least, not yet. She looked down at her hands. The blood on them was actually Alex's. Everything had gone as planned, except Alex had been hurt again. He claimed it was just a scratch. But to him, just a scratch meant a half dozen sutures. Currently, he and the Dolophon were hiding in Lonnie's dressing room, the least likely place anyone would look for the king's assassins, especially since everyone believed they were already caught. Some of the guards who'd been present when Alex was discovered were with him to watch over the Khemisar. She hoped he was getting some sleep. Once everything was in place, Sage had run screaming from Baneth's rooms and across to Lonnie's apartment, and Lonnie, in turn, raised the alarm. Darrett had been the first on the scene, after the guards in the outer passage. Because Darrett was the king's close friend and lead rider, all the guards had obeyed him when he ordered the palace locked down. Only council members were permitted to enter the gates, and they were escorted straight to the meeting chamber. Some got a detour to look into the king's room, but no one was allowed to get close to the body, lest they discover it was still breathing. Minister Cinda arrived in the middle of it all, neither too early nor too late. Lonnie had thrown herself at him, sobbing, and Sage suspected she enjoyed smearing as much blood on him as possible. Upon learning it was Sage who discovered the body, he'd ordered her and Nicholas confined to her quarters and the garden searched. She wasn't surprised when the bloody knife was found buried in the flowers near her patio. After all, she'd chosen the spot. The four guards in the room imposed silence every time she'd tried to speak to Nicholas, who looked terrified. Though he'd known since dinner there was some sort of ruse going on, Sage hadn't explained everything. Only assured him in their own language that Baneth wasn't dead, for all he was lying in his bed covered in blood. The council meeting was in full swing by now, and she expected to be called and accused at any minute,
she hoped it would be soon. Much as she disliked wearing all this blood, the king had to lie in it. As the sun rose, Sage began to feel agitated. They'd wanted this resolved by dawn, before the people in the city had a chance to hear the rumors of Banneth's death. Cinda was likely dragging this out to create maximum panic. Finally, she and Nicholas were called before the council and prodded by guards with spears all the way. They stood before the long table, still wearing their nightclothes, with over a dozen hostile faces staring at them. From the far end of the room, Lonnie flashed an icy smile. Minister Cinda stood and addressed everyone, making a long speech about how their nation had nursed two vipers to their chests, that he himself had been deceived by their innocent appearance and swayed by their beloved king's good but naive intentions. Sage remained calm throughout, taking Nicholas's hand when he began to tremble. She let Cinda say everything he wanted. His elaborate knowledge and story would only work against him once they were proved false when Banneth simply showed up alive. Cinda finished his speech and turned to the Damorans.
What have you to say for yourselves?
You have no proof, answered Sage.
Where were you last night? Cinda demanded.
After dinner with you and the royal family, I stayed up late with Princess Alania. As you may recall, you asked the king for her permission to marry her. We had much to talk on. The faces around the table looked to one another in surprise. Apparently, that hadn't been mentioned this morning. The minister had probably wanted to wait until he was the hero, when the news would have gone over well. Cinda was unfazed.
I recall another event from that dinner, do you?
Dessert was orange custard.
Do you find this amusing?
Cinda bellowed. She'd rattled him by not behaving as he'd expected.
The king is dead.
She blinked innocently. We hadn't gotten to that part yet. Lonnie put her face in her hands and sobbed, but Sage suspected she was actually laughing.
Our beloved king told me that he had proposed marriage to you.
Sage nodded. Yes, he did. Heads reeled again in shock. But why would I accept, only to kill him?
I don't know, said Cinda. Perhaps that was your entire purpose in coming to Casmon, to seduce our king and get close enough to assassinate him. It was you who discovered his body in the middle of the night.
And yet, I did not kill him, she said. Alex believed the Dolophon would have no reason not to identify the minister as their conspirator, but it couldn't be depended on, or that the council would accept their testimony. Cinda had to admit what he'd learned about Nicholas, and how, if possible, in front of everyone, so Alex's later testimony would ring true. The question was whether he wanted to hold that back for other purposes. Cinda gestured to a guard who came forward and set a bloody dagger on the table. The golden SF glittered in the sunlight streaming through the window.
Is this your weapon? Cinda asked.
Sage barely glanced at the knife. You know it is.
It was found buried in the royal family's garden, between your quarters and the king's.
That proves nothing, she said. It could have been put there to blame me. Sage was actually enjoying herself. The only thing she felt bad about was Nicholas's fear. She squeezed his hand in reassurance. I gain nothing from the king's death. As you pointed out, I have lost my chance to become Casmon's queen.
You act incredibly unconcerned, Mistress Sage.
Cinda turned to face the council.
Is that because you know your country is coming to your rescue? Is that why 400 Damoran troops are on their way to Ostiza right now?
Sage saw her opening to turn the focus on Nicholas a little. If so, it would appear they are a little too late to save my brother and me. Cinda snorted.
Your brother?
He looked back to her.
Or your prince?
A ripple of murmuring broke out among the council. Nicholas paled even more, and Sage squeezed his fingers again. The less she said, the more Cinda would have to reveal what he knew.
I learned this in questioning the Kimisar man who followed them into Kasman, Cinda told the men around the table. Something General Caladan could not be bothered to investigate, I might add.
The Minister of War's face went purple with rage, and Cinda raised an eyebrow at Sage.
Do you not deny Nicholas is the son of your king? That he was sent into Kasman to give your country an excuse to invade?
Those are two questions with different answers.
You will answer for your treason, shouted Cinda.
Derret had been standing by the double doors to the chamber. Now, he turned around to unbolt them.
I committed no treason, Minister, Sage said, dropping Nicholas's hand and stepping forward. The room was so riveted, no one noticed the doors opening. Unlike you, I have no duty to Kasman or its king.
His face triumphant, Cinda shook his head.
No, but you will stand trial for the king's murder, as will Nicholas.
The familiar silhouettes in the doorway brought a smile to Sage's lips.
That will be rather difficult, said Baneth.
Chapter 100. The only thing better than Minister Cinda's face when he saw Baneth was when he recognized Alex standing beside him. They strode into the room together, Alex three steps behind the king, as the council erupted in shouts. Several ministers fell out of their chairs and to their knees, thanking the spirit. Cinda's complexion took on a greenish cast, which only worsened when Lonnie came to stand by Sage. Baneth had cleaned up and changed, looking imposing and in complete control, unlike anyone else in the room. When the chaos had died down and everyone was back in their seats, except Cinda, who was rooted to the spot, the king called the council to order.
Gentlemen, he said, then paused to nod to Lonnie and Sage. As the full council is present, I invoke an emergency judgment trial, for the good of the nation, that we may resolve this matter quickly and decisively.
No one objected. Sage imagined they were still too shocked to understand what was happening.
At any time, any member may call for a judgment that will end the proceedings if the vote is unanimous in favor of guilt or innocence. The accused is allowed to call any witness in his defense until such a judgment is made.
Palandret, said the Minister of Roads weakly, who is on trial, and what are the charges?
Dev Cinda stands accused of treason, conspiracy, and attempted assassination of a sovereign. I am sure we could add bribery, but those will do.
I object, said Cinda, finding his voice. I will never vote in favor of my guilt. This trial is nullified.
Baneth had anticipated that.
The Minister of Finance is engaged to marry the Princess Alania. By law, such a close relationship to the royal family removes him from his post. Dev Cinda is no longer a voting member of this council.
Before Cinda could protest that a full council no longer existed, Lonnie spoke up.
I nominate Derret Yaman for the vacant position of Minister of Finance.
As king, I have the right to make an interim appointment, said Baneth. Derret Yaman, do you accept?
Derret bowed.
Yes, Palandret. So be it.
Guards appeared on either side of Cinda, stripping him of the knife he carried and searching him for more weapons. Sage was speechless at how well coordinated everything had been.
Now, said Baneth, taking his seat at the head of the table. I suggest we begin with my first two witnesses, as one isn't likely to live much longer.
The doors were opened, and four guards entered with the Dolophon. At the look of hatred from the Kimisar clutching his bloody stomach, Cinda panicked and bolted for the door.
but the guards were faster. In one last stroke of justice, it was Alex who produced a set of shackles to hold the accused. The first and only vote was held an hour later. Kazmuni law required a full day between sentencing and execution. Two mornings later, Dev Sinda was led to the block in the market square in front of the prison. Though Lani looked calm and regal as ever, she was on the verge of collapse, and Sage had her arm around her friend's waist to support her. The charges of conspiracy, treason, and attempted assassination of a sovereign were read aloud, and the verdict and sentence announced. Sinda stood silently, his shackled wrists hanging in front of him. His unkempt hair and lined face no longer looked handsome and distinguished, but rather cold and calculating. Baneth stepped forward, and the crowd sighed in audible relief. Despite immediate shutting down of the palace, rumors of his assassination had spread quickly, and people were glad to see for themselves they weren't true.
"Do you have anything to say for yourself?" the king said.
Sinda then turned his eyes to Sage and Nicholas.
"Do give the Khemisar my regards when you return home."
The Dolophon had failed, but the smug look on Sinda's face made Sage sick to her stomach.
"Wait!" she shouted in Kazmuni.
The executioner froze with his harish in the half-begun swing and looked to Baneth, who held up his hand to indicate he should halt. Sinda rotated his head from the block and looked up at her.
"Yes, my dear," he said mockingly.
"You sent the order for the garrison to stand down as soon as you thought the king was dead, didn't you?" she said. "The pass is open."
Or it would be within days. Sinda only smiled.
"Bas Medari, Seish Faller."
He turned to resettle his neck on the block.
"Let's get this over with."
Chapter 101. The Damorans arrived in Ostiza that evening to find a city in an uproar. Baneth was organizing as many troops as possible to march the next morning for the pass to the west. The distance was far, but the desert ground was solid enough that a road linked the capital to the fortress. 7 days was considered the minimum time needed. Baneth planned to do it in fewer than five. The king was busy, so Sage, Nicholas, and Alex rode out to meet the Damorans as they set up camp on the plain outside the city gates. Ambassador Gramwell was there, as Sage expected, but she was surprised to see Claire next to him. Alex stepped up to Colonel Traisden and saluted formally before requesting permission to report. While he explained everything to the ambassador and officers, Claire filled Sage in on what had happened on the Damoran side. That Sage and Nicholas went into Kazmin was known within a day. When Alex and two volunteers had gone into the desert after them, Kasik returned to a camp occupied by Colonel Traisden, who assumed command of the Norsari. While dispatches went flying to the capital, the Damorans pursued the Khemisar to the foothills of the Catrix, where they crossed into Kazmin, and the Norsari did not follow. Extra troops came across Jovan in case the Khemisar came back, but the Norsari and the unit Colonel Traisden brought headed for Vinova, anticipating permission from Tenegal to go after Nicholas the long way around. As soon as they had the authority, the ambassador and almost all the soldiers at Vinova headed south. Thanks to what Sage and Claire had learned, the Damorans never considered trying to cross the desert. Everyone finished their stories at about the same time, and they all stood looking at one another for a minute. Colonel Traisden cleared his throat.
"Captain Quinn, I hereby formally return command of Norsari Battalion 1 to you. It was my honor to serve as commander in your absence."
Alex saluted, and Sage could see he was holding back tears. The colonel returned the salute, and the moment was over.
"So, Captain," said Traisden, after the officers took turns shaking Alex's hand and welcoming him back, "when do we leave for the pass?"
they returned to the palace with Ambassador Gramwell, Claire, their retinue, and the news that the Damoran soldiers would march with them in the morning. Baneth took one look at the Damoran horses and insisted on providing Kazmuni mounts for the officers, saying the lighter, slender breeds they rode would be more reliable on a journey across the desert. Alex looked a little insulted, but he also acknowledged the Damoran horses were exhausted from pushing so hard to get to Ostheza. Lani offered her white stallion to Sage, and when that was translated for Alex, he shook his head.
You're staying here with Nicholas.
Sage crossed her arms. Who's going to choose your meals and underclothes if I'm not there? Alex opened his mouth to protest, then clamped it shut and exhaled through his nose, frowning. I'm going to have to watch you ride away for years, Alex, she said, stepping close to him and lowering her voice. I'll be damned if I do it when I don't have to. She put a hand on his crossed arms. I'll stay back from the fighting, I promise. He sighed.
Is this the wrong time to tell you how much you remind me of my mother?
Is that an attempt to dissuade me?
Only if it works, he said,
dropping his arms and planting a kiss on her forehead. 10 minutes later, Claire committed to coming too. Sage can't be out there alone, she said. Think of her reputation. Alex rolled his eyes, but didn't even try to object. They left at first light. But instead of heading directly for the road west, Baneth led them south, to a mountain of stone on the horizon. Outside an entrance carved into the rock, a wagon was being loaded with clay pots sealed with wax. Each time a vessel was put down, a man wrapped cloth around it, presumably so they wouldn't bang against one another while riding. What's this? Sage asked Baneth.
Come, I will show you. He said, dismounting. Bring Alex and his top men.
Sage signaled to them, and they gathered around a pot that had cracked and been set aside. Baneth picked it up carefully and gestured for everyone to stand back, then dropped it on the ground so it broke open. Among the shattered pottery was globs of what looked like apple jelly. The king poured a little water in his hand and sprinkled it over the mess. When the drops touched the jelly, it sizzled and flamed for a few seconds.
It is an ancient weapon most Kazmuni do not even remember we ever possessed, said Baneth, as Sage translated. Water is what makes the flame. You must never touch it. Even the sweat on your skin is enough to set it off.
The king took another step away from the pot and jelly and squeezed a stream of water on it. Flames leapt up, making everyone jump back. As they watched, the heat of the fire melted the sand and stone around it into black glass.
We call it Dremvasha, said Baneth.
Water fire. Is it made with oil? Sage asked, and Baneth nodded. So if you put this on a large water, it will float and spread?
Yes.
Baneth slung his waterskin back over his shoulder.
It was done once before, many years ago. The devastation lasts to this day.
Sage watched the liquid jelly slide down the glass until it reached more sand, which it melted in a lengthening trail. Corporal Wilder had described the desolate canyon on the border with Kazmin as steep and smooth, with sides like jagged broken glass. Deadly. This was what had done that. Yanli Gorge, she whispered, and Baneth nodded. Alex looked at her questioningly, and she explained to him and the others. He shook his head in awe.
Sage, the oldest maps labeled Yanli as a plain. That gorge wasn't just melted. The entire thing had to have been formed by this, all 40 miles.
As they mounted their horses and moved on with the loaded wagons, Sage looked back to see the flames were still burning. Chapter 102. The Kazmuni and Damorans arrived at the pass 5 days later, to find the fortress built into the cliff, abandoned. For now, Alex and Banith were less concerned about where those men had gone than with setting up their defense. The king led the way through the gap in the rock, which was only wide enough for 5 mounted men to stand across. A few dozen yards beyond that, however, the passage suddenly widened into a bowl-shaped area, large enough to hold about 1,000 men, before narrowing again. Alex studied the curved edges of the bowl. The almost perfect circle didn't look natural. At his question, the king replied that it had been deliberately mined as a quarry centuries ago to form the shape. The idea was to create a place for the first line of defense. If that failed, the invaders still had to go through the neck, as the outer narrow gap was called, where the Kazmuni would have a second chance to defeat them with the land.
But that means the men fighting in here can be trapped, unable to retreat, said Alex.
Banith nodded.
That is the trade we made for 2 places to stop the enemy. 1 place that may also stop us. But the loss would not be great. Only a few hundred.
It was a good space to fight with the number they'd brought, but there was no one outside the pass to back them up.
Do you think we made it in time?
Alex asked. His biggest fear had been arriving only to see the tail end of the Khimasar army headed north. Banith gestured to a spot on the ground where the sand had a flowing look.
The river here has only recently dried up. If they had passed through in the last week, we would see it there.
Next to them, Colonel Traisden nodded his agreement. He'd come along with his own unit, which was small for his rank, but he made no move to interfere with how Alex commanded the Norsari.
Where do we use the water fire? Traisden asked.
The king led them out of the bowl and deeper into the pass, where it was wide enough for 10 armed men to walk abreast. After about 1/4 mile, the pass had several snake-like bends. He stopped and pointed up to the rock ledges partway up the almost sheer sides of the canyon.
Here, I think. If we can drop enough fire on their heads while they are backed up, trying to enter the bowl, perhaps they will retreat.
Alex nodded. Not a bad plan for 10-1 odds. Chapter 103 Sage and Claire were left to themselves while the soldiers prepared. The number of men seemed pathetically small when Sage considered how many thousands were likely to come through the pass. More Kazmuni soldiers would eventually arrive in support. But if the Khimasar came in the next 3 or 4 days, the force here was all there was between them and Demora. Crates were constructed to hold the pots of Dremvasha, and they were hauled up and along a ledge that ran the length of the pass about 40 feet up. Barrels of water were placed nearby for setting the water fire ablaze. Scouts ventured deeper into the pass, looking for signs of Khimasar on the march, but between the narrowness and frequent bends, it was difficult to see ahead in most places. Depending on how fast the messengers could run, there would only be a few hours' warning. Alex was almost healed from his time in the dungeon, which was a relief, as he would have fought, no matter his condition. He told Sage and Claire that when the time came, their place was at the high watchtower of the fortress, and Sage fully intended to obey that. When the time came. Their second day passed slower than any she could remember. Every noise made them jump, and her hand ached from constantly gripping the hilt of her sword. The men, too, were irritable, and snapped and argued over the most minor of slights. Lieutenant Cassock had to break up 2 men before they came to blows. When night fell, she sat under the stars with Alex in the bowl, ready to fall asleep on his shoulder from being so tense all day. Is it always like this? She asked. Before a battle?
Pretty much, he said. It's why some men charge into a fight when they're at a disadvantage. They're too impatient to wait for the better moment.
Thinking before I act isn't my strength, said Sage.
I don't think I'd make a very good soldier.
Alex nuzzled her hair with his nose. Love, you are one of the bravest, fiercest people I know.
He kissed her head.
And that is the truth.
There were few higher compliments he could offer. Sage wasn't sure she had the kind of bravery needed on the battlefield, though. Alex suddenly leapt to his feet, nearly knocking her over. Shouting echoed out of the pass, and all around them, soldiers were standing up, including Lieutenant Gramwell, who'd been sitting with Claire not far away. Alex helped her up, and she resisted the urge to hold on to his arm, in case he needed to draw his sword. Two men came flying out of the gate of stone. One dropped to his knees, panting, and the other bent over and vomited from running so hard.
They're coming, the man on the ground gasped. They'll be here by sunrise.
Everyone was moving in a matter of seconds. Alex swept Sage close with an arm around her waist and kissed her.
This is it, he said. Go to the fortress. Watch everything. If we fail, you and Claire have to get back to Ostheza and tell everyone what happened.
You mean just leave you here? Sage cried.
Yes.
He pressed his forehead to hers as orders were shouted around them in two languages.
Promise me, Sage. I can't focus down here unless I know you'll be safe.
She nodded reluctantly, and he kissed her again, slowly this time, like he had all the time in the world. Then Claire was pulling on her hand, and they were running to the horses, already being saddled for them. Sage led the way back through the neck, hearing the reports of readiness behind them. Outside the canyon, they hooked around to the right and into the shelter of the fortress. She didn't want to leave the horses saddled. It felt like expecting defeat. But she'd promised Alex they'd be ready to flee. By the time she and Claire made it to the top of the tower, half the stars had faded. Rows of troops spread out in the twilight below, looking pathetically small, even in the contained area of the bowl. Beside her, Claire's face was parchment white, and her mouth drawn into a thin line.
I wish I hadn't come, she muttered.
Sage was about to answer her, when the glow of flames could be seen reflecting off the stone walls leading into the pass.
Was it the Dremvasha? That should have been too far to see.
But no, it was torches carried by the lead rank to light the way through the dark canyon. The first Khimasar burst into the open area, appearing surprised to find opposition. The Kazmuni and Damorans charged. For the first hour, the Khimasar made little progress. Every time they gained a few yards into the bowl, the allied fighters drove them back again. Sage could see their side rotating men, having them peel away from the fight to let the fresher rank behind them take over. The sun peeked over the horizon, shining light into the battlefield through the neck. If the Dremvasha was having an effect, Sage didn't see it.
Sage!
Claire tugged on her arm, but Sage was glued to the battle, trying to pick out the one figure she cared about most.
Sage!
What? She snapped, harsher than she meant to. The fortress's watchtower was built to see both into the bowl and outside the pass itself. Claire pointed at the flat plain below.
Who is that?
Sage squinted at a column of figures approaching from the north, along the slopes. It couldn't be reinforcements. No one lived in that direction. Sage led Claire down the steps of the tower, to where they could look out a window and not be seen by the advancing group. The first of the new arrivals reached the mouth of the canyon, and after a brief discussion, several entered the pass. A few minutes later they returned, and others gathered around them.
Come on.
Sage went lower to find a better place to look out at the men, and Claire followed.
They look like Damorans, Claire whispered,
and Sage nodded in agreement. Their clothes were definitely Damoran in style, but everything was worn and filthy, like they'd come a long way. Sage crept closer to the window, until she could overhear them talking. Khimasar. They were discussing what they'd seen in the bowl, concluding whoever had their backs to them were fighting their countrymen. Several wanted to join in. Sage tried to make a quick count, getting lost twice at 100 as they shifted around. But she was sure there were more than enough to cause a major problem. The Kazmuni and Demorans weren't expecting danger from the east. With the rising sun, they wouldn't even see the Kimisar coming until they were right behind them.
"What do we do?" whispered Claire.
Chapter 104. Hazar had tried to make it to the pass before dawn, hoping for the chance to sneak in under cover of darkness. As he and his men approached, he saw no light coming from the fortress in the rock, as if no one was there. Seeing nothing to stop them, Hazar decided to continue, even as sunlight poured over the horizon. The sound of shouting and metal on metal echoed out of the entrance to the pass, and he sent a few men in to investigate. There was fighting in the round area beyond the narrow opening. That must be where the men manning the fortress had gone, to stop Kimisar coming through the pass. Hazar's numbers were few, barely over 120, but the Kazmuni were trapped in the bowl. If he came in from behind the main battle, the Kimisar could wear the Kazmuni down on two fronts. He discussed it with the men around him, and they were all eager to join the fight. This was what real soldiers did, not ally with traitors, not take young boys hostage. They didn't die under rock slides. They faced their enemies and fought like men. Hazar was organizing the company into columns and instructing them how he wanted them to spread out, when a scream interrupted him. A white horse came flying around the fortress wall, ridden by a Kazmuni man waving a sword. The Kimisar instinctively scattered out of his way, and the rider flew into the pass. Shit. Just as the Kazmuni weren't looking behind them, Hazar had been complacent about who could sneak up on the Kimisar. The rider hadn't attacked, though. He was going to warn the Kazmuni inside. Hazar had lost the element of surprise. Chapter 105. Alex rotated to the rear ranks of the Allied soldiers, taking the chance to catch his breath. Gramwell was next to him, leaning on his sword and panting.
"Where's the damn water fire?" Alex said. "I haven't seen any sign it's being used."
"Want me to go look?"
asked Gram.
"Maybe you should."
The whinny of a horse made Alex turn around. Out of the golden light streaming through the pass came a rider on a white horse. He headed straight for Alex and skidded to a halt in front of him.
"Alex," Sage shouted down at him. "Thank the spirit."
She sheathed the sword she was carrying.
"What the hell are you doing here, Sage?"
She waved a gloved hand behind her.
"Kimisar," she gasped, "coming from behind."
"Where the bleeding hell did they come from?"
"I don't know," she said, "but there's over 100.
Alex grabbed the man next to him.
"Turn around, turn everyone around, they're coming from behind us."
Soldiers began to react, forming a rear line.
"Sage, you need to get out of here."
"I can't," she said, "not till all those Kimisar come through."
She was right. Just then, a Demoran came running toward them, calling for Captain Quinn.
"Over here," he shouted back.
A man from the Dremvasha detail collapsed in front of Alex.
"Sir, the water fire. There's a rock slide. It's half buried, and so are most of the men. We can't use it."
"Here they come,"
someone yelled, and dozens of Kimisar came running out of the sunlight. Sage kicked the horse to get behind the line of fighting. Alex followed, keeping himself between her and the Kimisar.
"I heard what he said about the Dremvasha," she shouted over the noise and pointed to the path up the ridge. "I can't go back. Let me go help up there."
Alex held her gaze for a pair of heartbeats, then nodded and grabbed Lieutenant Gramwell beside him.
"Go with her, Luke."
Sage yanked the reins around and took off for the canyon. Chapter 106. Sage abandoned Lonnie's horse when the ground became too steep for him to climb and scrambled up the side of the bowl on her hands and knees. From the ledge, she paused to look down on the battle below. The Kimisar coming from behind had changed the whole dynamic. She ran along the ridge and into the canyon mouth, trying to ignore the 40-foot drop on her right. The air became thick with dust, and the stone vibrated under her feet with the rhythm of the soldiers passing below. That must have set off the landslide. Sage pulled her headscarf up to cover her face and stepped over an arm sticking out of a pile of dirt and rock. At the last second, she stooped to brush her fingers across the dead man's palm, whispering a quick prayer. Several soldiers were ahead, digging with hands and makeshift tools to free a crate of Drimvasha, half buried in the hillside. The crate came free, but it was full of dirt now, too. A pair of men dragged it toward the ledge, and the earth above began shifting to fill the new hole. Sage screamed for them to get out of the way as the hillside came loose and pushed the crate over the edge, along with one of the men. Watching him tumble made her dizzy enough to turn away and hug the slope behind her. When the dust settled, Sage was on one side of a vertical scar across the hill, while three men on the other side held on to the last crate, which had been ripped open. She looked down on the Kimisar below. Drimvasha and pottery lay strewn on a newly formed hill, and the Kimisar ran over and around it. There was no sign of the man they'd lost, and she hoped for his sake he hadn't survived the fall. Every few seconds, another rank of Kimisar passed, faster than before, headed into the narrow entrance to the bowl. The only way to end this was to cut off the supply of invaders entirely. Sage looked back to the men on the other side of the rock slide. "Throw it all out," she shouted and waved. Clay pot after clay pot went over, the sounds of shattering pottery lost, for the most part, in the movement below. The only thing left was the water, which was on her side. Sage turned around to find the barrels of water half buried. She began flinging rocks away with her hands, grateful she still wore her riding gloves. One of the men on the Drimvasha side called out, telling her to break them open rather than dig them out. Sage reached for her sword, but the soldier shouted again and stretched across the scree between them to hand her an axe. Yes, that was probably better. Sage reached back, but she couldn't quite grasp it, and he had to toss it to her. A quick glance assured her the last of the Drimvasha would be on the ground soon. Sage gripped the axe with both hands as she turned back to the barrels and took a horizontal swing. The blade bounced off, jarring every bone in her body, and she nearly lost her footing. Setting her feet, she tried again, this time aiming at a downward angle. A few heavy splinters came off, but it was better than nothing. Again and again she hacked at the barrel, sometimes switching to an upward angle to make the opening that was taking shape wider. When she felt she'd weakened it to the last few blows, Sage climbed over the barrels to the other side. Once the water was released, she'd only have a few seconds to get the other barrel open before the canyon below went up in flames. She worked the second as she had the first, until she felt sure a couple more hits would have it spraying water over the ledge. Sage stopped for a moment to look back the way she'd come, as Lieutenant Gramwell came flying down the path, covered in dirt and blood.
"Kimisar coming behind me," he shouted. "Run!"
"I can't," she yelled. "I have to get these open."
Graham stopped and took in the situation, then nodded.
"All right, do it. I'll hold them off."
He turned and set his feet, gripping his sword with both hands. If she wanted to escape, she needed to be on the other side. Sage scrambled over the barrels again to where she'd begun, then raised the axe to break open the one on the opposite side. After three hits, the barrel burst open, pouring water from the hole in its side and onto the Drimvasha below. Sage was positioning herself to finish the second when Gramwell staggered back against the barrel, gasping his face gray. Sage screamed his name and dropped the axe.